Hello and welcome to the Late and Cassette Podcast, and today I'll be diving headfirst into the Friday the 13th franchise. Friday the 13th was the brainchild of producer and director Sean S. Cunningham. Cunningham had seen the success of John Carpenter's Halloween, and Cunningham hired writer Victor Miller to rip it off, as Miller put it. Cunningham had made some softcore porn movies in the 70s and a couple of kids' sports movies as well. He had worked as a producer on Wes Craven's 1972 movie, The Last House on the Left. They had the name for the movie before they even had an idea of what they were going to do, alleges Cunningham, and Cunningham took out an ad in Variety for the movie with the tagline, "The most terrifying film ever made," to see if he could find anyone interested in financing the film. He was able to get the funding from the same group that financed Last House on the Left, Georgetown Productions. Now, I say allegedly because I'd heard various places that Cunningham, when he hired Victor Miller, his idea was just to rip off Halloween, and the original title to Friday was A Long Night at Camp Blood. Maybe that was like a working title or something, but I did most of my research for this on the Crystal Lake Memories Blu-ray set that came out a few years ago. And they don't mention that at all. Cunningham, just in the documentary, says he already had the title. And I'm not really a big fan of Cunningham. It really doesn't have anything to do with his movies. I just kind of think he's a fucking worm, but I digress. Victor Miller then wrote the script, and the venue of a summer camp was chosen so that the teens were isolated and away from any kind of parental help. This first movie is meant to be a whodunit type of story, and Miller wrote that during the killer's point of view shots, we would see the killer was missing an index finger, but that was cut due to time and budget reasons. They filmed it at a Boy Scout camp, Camp Nabosco, in the fall of 1979. I probably butchered that. And there are a couple scenes where you can definitely tell it's fall time. And the movie takes place in the same place that it was shot, New Jersey. Most of the camp counselors were actors from the New York theater scene, and our actors are Adrian King as Alice, Harry Crosby, the son of former singer and everybody's favorite snowman when Rudolph comes on, Bing Crosby, and Harry plays Bill. Kaneen Taylor plays Marcy, Laurie Bartiram as Brenda, Mark Nelson as Ned, Robbie Morgan as Annie, Peter Brower as Steve Christie, Rex Everhart as Enos, Walt Gourney as Crazy Ralph, Ari Lehman as Jason Voorhees, Betsy Palmer as Mrs. Voorhees. Palmer hated the script and only did the movie because she needed a new car at the time. She says, "It'll come and it'll go and nobody will remember." If only she was a fortune teller. And I saved the biggest star for last, Kevin Bacon as Jack. Special effects guru Tom Savini, who is the Michael Jordan of horror movie effects, was in charge of the special effects on this one. Harry Manfredini handled the score, and when I say handled, I mean rip off the scores of Psycho and Jaws and pretty much mash them up. He also created the iconic k-k-k-ma-ma-ma sound by saying those words into an Echoplex, which was a music mixing machine that was popular in the 70s and 80s. However, behind the scenes, Georgetown Productions weren't totally happy with the script, so they sent Ron Kurz to do some uncredited rewrites. Kurz, along with everybody else from Tom Savini to Sean Cunningham, take credit for the iconic shot when we see Jason for the first time jumping out of the lake. Originally, Sean Cunningham's son Noel was supposed to be young Jason, but his mother refused, so the job went to Ari Lehman. And this Kurz, this Ron Kurz guy, he's a real cunt. I don't like him. Some people don't come off particularly likable in this documentary. I'll just leave it at that. And he's one of them. Paramount Pictures ended up picking the movie up after it was completed. Paramount put millions behind marketing the movie. The production budget Cunningham had to work with before it was picked up was only $550,000. Friday the 13th was released May 9th, 1980, and made a stunning $59.8 million during its theatrical run. I don't really mention critics and what they think because fuck 'em, right? But here I'll mention that Friday the 13th got scathing reviews from the media, with legendary critic Gene Siskel going as far as to give Betsy Palmer's address in one of his columns and urging fans to write to her about their outrage that she would participate in a movie like this. Another thing to come out of this movie is because it made so much money and because it was picked up by Paramount and given sort of full court press release, more low budget slasher films were popularized because of Friday the 13th success. You can owe a debt of ha you know, a Halloween's like the godfather of them all to me. They all owe Halloween a little tip of the cap. We saw lots of day themed horror movies, April Fool's Day, Prom Night, Silent Night, Deadly Night, even though there was Black Christmas before that, so. But nothing to it but to do it, so let's check it out and see if this holds up as a classic still. We start out at Camp Crystal Lake in 1958. Some counselors gather in a cabin to sing some kumbaya type shit while we get a POV shot of someone very creepily walking into another cabin with sleeping kids. I should mention here that I'm watching the uncut version, and I believe the scene walking through the cabin with the kids was a something that wasn't in the original one that was released on VHS and in theaters. Anywho, we cut to the back of this merry band of dickheads singing and shit. It seems they are singing some religious songs, which, hey, I have no problem with. I do, however, find it odd that two of the counselors sneak away to go fuck. Guess it's time to get to know each other biblically. They go upstairs in one of the cabins and get busy. We get more POV, and then whoever's POV we have, here's what they're doing, and this person heads upstairs to bust them. The dude goes to plead his case, and he gets fucking shanked. The chick throws some boxes at the person, and we get a freeze frame on her face. Then we get the title screen and opening credits. We cut to Friday, June 13th, present day, so 2020. Well, we all know it's supposed to be 1980, of course. And actually, I think they kind of retconned it, so it's 79. Not to get too far ahead, but one thing that will happen as we get into this franchise is the continuity is totally fucked. We follow a young woman walking through a sleepy town. She walks into a diner and asks for directions to Camp Crystal Lake. The folks inside look at her like she's a fucking alien. One of them even refers to the place as Camp Blood. A truck driver offers her a ride part way, at least. On their walk to his truck, one of the townspeople, Crazy Ralph, tells her that she will die and the place has a death curse. As Enos, the truck driver, helps Annie, the girl, get into his truck, he grabs a handful of ass. He was trying to get it. On their ride, Enos tells Annie of the camp's troubles. In 1957, a kid drowned. The next summer, two counselors were murdered. Fires were set throughout the years, and when they were to reopen in 1962, the water was bad, and no one has a clue who did any of it. But that hardly qualifies for the nickname of Camp Blood, in my opinion. Enos implores her to quit. She refuses, of course. He lets her out at an intersection so she can finish her journey, and he takes off. We cut to a trio of kids on their way, including a young Kevin Bacon. They arrive and meet Steve Christie, the owner, who looks a lot like my old man did in the mid to late 80s, and it's a little unsettling. We also meet Annie, who is hanging some gutters. Steve macks on her a bit and asks her to stay. She is thinking about heading back to California for some reason. And he asks her to give him another week before she makes up her mind. He very fucking creepily touches her face and hair after she agrees before he peaces out. We get a POV shot of someone watching Alice run through the woods as she goes to talk to Bill. And Bill kind of seems like he may be a potential love interest for Alice. Alice doesn't really seem like she's that into Steve, but they only have a couple of scenes together. Steve gives everyone some marching orders before he heads to town. Ned tries flirting with Brenda. He was the one who was with Kevin Bacon and his girlfriend. Brenda was another worker who was at the camp when they arrived. His idea of flirting is shooting an arrow towards the target she is setting up at the archery range. And Ned is going to be fucking annoying. We cut back to Annie, who hitches a ride in a Jeep, much like the one Steve just left in. She talks to the driver, but we never see or hear the driver. The driver speeds past the road, and Annie asks the driver to turn around, but they just speed up. So Annie, sensing she is in danger, jumps out of the Jeep and runs into the woods, as the driver follows her on foot. It seems she may be safe, but her pursuer appears in front of Annie and slits her throat. Doesn't look like she's going to be cooking for anyone this summer. She was supposed to be the camp cook. We go back to the camp, and our 25-year-old looking teens are taking a break from work to swim and fuck off. We see our killer watching from a distance. They get ready to go back to work when Ned calls out for help. Bacon and the rest rescue him, and when Brenda goes to give him mouth-to-mouth, he kisses her, showing it was all a ruse. We cut to Alice, who gets spooked by a snake in her cabin. She calls to Bill, who comes running in with his machete. The rest of the counselors come in and tear the damn place apart looking for the snake. They eventually flush it out, and Bill kills it, looking very proud of himself after the deed is done. This was a real snake that they really killed in the movie. If you did something like that these days, Peter would be so far up your ass they would be able to tell what you had for dinner last night. But I hate snakes, so fuck that snake, and I'm glad it's dead. A cop shows up while Ned is doing what would be considered a very offensive Native American dance. The cop does typical cop things, like giving the teens a hard time about smoking pot and such. He tells them he's there looking for Ralph, our town crazy. He gets a call on his radio to come back to town. He turns his bike around and heads out. A couple of notes on this scene. As I said, I'm using the Crystal Lake Memories documentary. And as the guy who played the cop was on the dock, he said that he couldn't actually ride and he crashed the bike on the first take. Writer Victor Miller also said he had a problem with the scene, as it was written by the uncredited Kurz, because Miller felt it took the isolation aspect away if people were just showing up, which I can kind of buy. Alice is putting some things away in the kitchen when she opens the door. Crazy Ralph is in there, and he spouts his bullshit before he gets on his pedal bike and splits. The teens prepare for dinner while Bacon, Bill, and Brenda go work on the generator because the power is down. They get it working, luckily for them. Later on, Ned watches Jack, who is Kevin Bacon, I should refer to him by his screen name, and Marcy make out. And I think someone, either Miller or Cunningham, might have had a voyeur fetish, because there's lots of watching people. In this scene here, we see some of the tree's reflection in the water, and you can see some of the trees have yellow and brown leaves. That'd be pretty odd for June. While Ned is walking down a trail, he sees someone walk into a cabin, and he follows them, asking if he can help them. It's starting to thunder and lightning, and Jack warns us that a storm is coming. They rush to get indoors before the storm starts, and they end up in the same cabin Ned followed the stranger into. Marcy depantses herself. Jack and her start getting hot and heavy. Alice, Bill, and Brenda chill in the main cabin, and Brenda has the idea to play strip Monopoly. Random thought, but does anyone out there remember the strip poker TV show that used to be on late night in the 90s? Used to love that shit as a horny preteen. We cut back to Jack and Marcy fucking. The camera pans to the top bunk of the bunk bed set they are on, and we see Ned's dead body on the top bunk with his throat slit. Get the fuck out of here, Ned. Alice, Brenda, and Bill smoke a joint and have a beer as they start their game. We cut back to Jack and Marcy. Marcy gets up to go take a piss. Jack lights up a joint while waiting for her to get back. And we get one of the most iconic kills of the franchise, probably because it's Beckon. A hand comes out from under the bed and grabs his head to keep it in place, and the killer shoves an arrow through his neck, causing blood to spurt everywhere. Savini said in the doc that the blood shooting up like it did was a happy accident because the contraption that they used to make the blood ooze out broke, and his assistant grabbed the tube that had the blood in it and blew through it, and it caused the blood to like shoot like it did. It's a pretty cool visual still. I mean, watching it in Blu-ray in 2020, you can see that it's fake as fuck. The neck mold for Kevin Bacon, but it still looks cool. Marcy makes it to the bathroom, but someone else walks in behind her after she's all settled on the can. The camera pans the bottom of the stalls, and we see what I find to be the most fucking disgusting thing in this movie. She ran too and is in the bathroom barefoot. Fucking barefoot. Yuck. I can see being barefoot outside, but to go in those bathrooms, ugh. I guess you don't have kids pissing all over the place yet though, but still gross. And once more, it seems she doesn't wipe when she gets up. This girl is fucking gross. She does some impressions in the mirror and thinks she hears someone in there as well. She goes to investigate, but doesn't see anyone in the back. The back room has like the showers and stuff. Then we see an axe being raised behind her. She turns around, sees the person, and just screams, stands there, and takes an axe to the fucking face. Didn't even try and fight back, just took her medicine and died like a piece of shit. Like, oh, well, I guess this is it. Fuck it, I'm dead. Idiot. Back to the Monopoly game, Brenda loses her shirt, and we get a Richard Nixon joke here. Alice is about to lose her shirt when suddenly the door blows open, and Brenda suddenly remembers she left her cabin windows open. It's supposedly been raining for quite a while, and she suddenly remembers her windows are open? Fucking idiot. So she heads out in her bra and underwear because apparently she can't get dressed. And I'll mention here that Bill was someone we were supposed to suspect early in the movie of being the killer, but it's obviously not him as he'd been sitting here playing Monopoly all evening. Bill and Alice flirt a bit as they clean the cabin up. We cut to Steve sitting at a diner, the old waitress, and he flirt before he heads out. He told the teens before he left he'd be back shortly after lunch. Guess he wanted that old-ass piece of pie. Brenda goes to the bathroom and thinks she hears a noise as well, but carries on brushing her teeth. However, we see a hand behind one of the shower curtains in the back. She manages not to get killed and heads to her cabin. We cut to Steve in his Jeep. He drove off the road. Apparently this dumbass can't drive in the rain. He can't get it started again and hitches a ride with a cop who happened to be driving by. Someone watches Brenda through the window of her cabin as she prepares for bed. She gets in her bed and starts reading a book when she hears what sounds like a little kid yelling, "Help me!" She goes to investigate. She follows the voice to the archery range. We see someone turn on the lights and she thinks it's a joke. We cut away and just hear her screaming. Alice is hanging out by herself in the main cabin when Bill comes in from checking the generator. She tells Bill she thought she heard Brenda scream and the lights on at the archery range. When they check, the lights are off. But her and Bill go to investigate anyway. They make it to her cabin, but Brenda is nowhere in sight. Bill finds an axe in one of the beds. They split and head to the cabin where Jack and Marcy are supposed to sleep, but it's empty as well. So is the bathroom. Alice is spooked and wants to call someone. They get to the office but can't find the key. So Alice does the only sensible thing and smashes a window. They pick up the phone, but it's dead. We can see outside the cabin that the line has been cut. They also try the payphone with no luck, of course. They try to start up Bill's truck, but to the shock of absolutely no one, it doesn't start. The cop tells Steve that they have more murders, thefts, and rapes on nights with full moons. The cop gets a call to an accident, so he lets Steve off at the end of the road of where the camp is. Steve heads in, but stops in his tracks when someone shines a flashlight in his face. He seems to know the person, but is stabbed before he can say much. Our killer then enters the room that has the generator in it and cuts all the power. Bill readies some lanterns. He makes the two most fatal mistakes you can make in a horror movie, which may have been born here. Going to check the generator alone and telling Alice he will be right back, almost certainly guaranteeing he won't. He checks some things on it, and we cut back to Alice, who wakes up from her nap. Alice goes to fix them some instant coffee. Ugh. And we get a long-ass scene of her preparing this coffee. It goes on for quite a while, like, maybe Cunningham thought the way she prepared coffee was hot, but it was long and it was fucking pointless. Eventually, she goes to look for Bill. She looks in the generator room but can't find him until she closes the door. The door had been wide open when she walked in, and when she closes it to shut it, we see Bill dead, stuck to the door with arrows through his eye, and I believe it was his neck or his shoulder, and his throat slit. She screams, of course, and runs through the woods. She makes it back to the cabin and tries to barricade the door. Even though the door opens outwards, it swings to the outside instead of inside, so if someone wanted in there, they'd just have to move the pile of shit. She gets a baseball bat and one of those big two-pronged forks you cook with to use as weapons. Just as she tries to calm down, Brenda's body comes crashing through the window right in front of her. The fuck out of here, Brenda. Tom Savini was the stuntman who came crashing through the window in a nightgown and a wig. Alice sees a Jeep approaching and moves all the shit and goes running out because she thinks it's Steve. However, it's a middle-aged woman who introduces herself as Mrs. Voorhees, a former employee and a friend of the Christies. Alice tells her that all her friends are dead, and Mrs. Voorhees goes to investigate. Mrs. Voorhees sees Brenda's body and she freaks out a bit and goes on to tell a story about a young boy who drowned and tells Alice they can go. Mrs. Voorhees then has visions of the boy drowning and tells him that she is helping. Mrs. Voorhees tells Alice that Jason, the boy who drowned, was her son and today is his birthday. She then comes after Alice, and Alice is able to get her down momentarily with a fire poker. She goes to get in the Jeep, but sees Annie's body and runs back into the camp. This girl's fucking stupid. A lot of our famous horror movie tropes we get here. As she's running back into the camp, we see Steve's body hanging upside down. Mrs. Voorhees emerges from the cabin and watches Alice run through the camp and speaks in Jason's voice. She then answers, "Jason." Safe to say this bitch is batshit crazy. Alice runs into a shed where they keep the rifles, but she's having a hard time finding bullets. Turns out they are in a locked drawer. No kidding, you can't have fucking loose bullets with guns laying around if you're gonna have kids there. Mrs. Voorhees turns the generator back on and goes to confront Alice in the shed. Mrs. Voorhees gets the upper hand a bit before Alice gives her a couple good smacks and takes off again. Another funny little side story here. In the documentary, Betsy Palmer says that she was mostly a stage actress, and when you smack someone on stage, you actually smack them. So when she went to smack Adrian King, the actor who plays Alice, she actually smacked her, and I guess Adrian freaked out a bit and wasn't happy. Alice returns to the main cabin after she's able to momentarily incapacitate Mrs. Voorhees. Mrs. Voorhees comes into the... Alice returns to the cabin, hides in the pantry, and Mrs. Voorhees comes back in there and searches the place. It seems she leaves, and Alice starts breathing a little easier until she hears the knob jiggling. Mrs. Voorhees is able to break the door just enough so that she can put her hand through it and unlock it. She swings a machete at Alice, but Alice is able to knock her out with a cast iron pan. Alice goes and sits by a canoe on shore and sees Mrs. Voorhees coming up behind her, reflection in the water. Alice uses a boat oar to block the machete and is able to knock the machete away from Mrs. Voorhees. They wrestle around a bit before Alice is able to get some separation, and she runs and grabs the machete and knocks Mrs. Voorhees' head clean off. Alice gets into the canoe and heads out to the center of the lake. Another thing here is Mrs. Voorhees' hands come up and they kind of like clench open and close a couple minutes, well, a couple seconds. But whenever we see this, we see hairy ass knuckles on a ring she wasn't wearing. It's because it was one of Savini's assistants who actually did the hand gestures. I don't think in 1980 they had any idea we would have HD television one day, or HD TVs. We cut to the morning, and Alice is still in the canoe. And it's in this scene where we can really see the leaves of fall. A lot of trees look have that reddish, yellowish tint to them. Happy music pipes up as cop car comes speeding down the road. Alice wakes up and sees the cops relieved. Her night of terror is finally over. Just as everything seems okay, the scary music pipes up and we see a muddy, almost decomposing child jump up and pull her into the lake. Alice wakes up screaming in the hospital. After she calms down, she asks if everyone is dead. The cop answers yes. And she asks about the boy. The cop seems perplexed and says they didn't find a boy. Alice says he must still be there then. We cut back to the lake for a beat or two, and the credits roll with the happy music. Positives. This is a pretty good movie. Hell, it's a fucking classic. Some good jump scares, some decent acting for the most part, and a pretty good score even though it's a ripoff. And that final scene is iconic. A lot of the, some of the people on the documentary even said that they don't know if the movie would have been as big, you know, that it would have had the life that it had, had it not been for that final jump scare, which was kind of a ripoff of Carrie whenever, if you ever seen Carrie, when there's the girl at the end where Carrie's house, Carrie went crazy and fucking pulled her house down, the hand that comes up out of the ground and grabs her. That's what really this was, a knockoff of that. The negatives, though, it's supposed to be a whodunit, but they don't introduce Mrs. Voorhees until the last 15 minutes, so that's kind of cheating. The characters aren't really developed, and there's no such time for those things in a slasher movie. This, like I said, this is a classic, and it spawned a powerhouse of a franchise throughout the 1980s. But most everyone knows Jason is the killer of the franchise, which I did as well before I even ever saw Friday the 13th movie. So if you have that knowledge, you lose the mystery aspect of this one, because most people know his mother was the killer in the first movie, especially if you've seen Scream before this. I don't believe that I knew that Jason wasn't the killer, because I remember being disappointed that you really didn't see him the first time I watched it. I remember the first time I watched it was the summer of 2001. That was almost 20 years ago. Jesus, it's fucking frightening to think about. Next week, I'll check out Friday the 13th Part 2 as Jason takes up the mantle from his mommy. And we'll see how this one holds up against the first one. Don't forget to follow on Twitter and like on Facebook. And we will be back next week with Friday the 13th, Part 2.